Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It was polished boots and bright red hammer and sickle flags again this morning in Moscow's Red Square. War veterans and world leaders gathered to mark the 60th anniversary of the World War II Allied victory over the Nazis and to pay tribute to the 27 million Soviet soldiers and citizens who died in the war. President Bush had the seat of honor next to Russia's President Vladimir Putin, but appearances can be deceiving. Big smiles and matching red carnations aside, there are mounting strains in this relationship. On his way to Moscow, Bush publicly denounced the Soviet domination, of Eastern Europe after the defeat of the Nazis, cheered democracy movements all along Russia's border, and raised questions about the political drift inside Putin's Russia. President Putin has refused to apologize for the Soviet occupations and bristled at the charge that Russia is sliding back into dictatorship. Last night, in an interview with Mike Wallace on the CBS News show 60 Minutes, Putin, speaking through an interpreter, criticized how democracy works in the United States.
In the United States, you first elect the electors and then they vote for the presidential candidates. In Russia, the president is elected through the direct vote of the whole population. That might be even more democratic. And you have other problems in your elections. 4 years ago, your presidential election was decided by the court. But we're not going to poke our nose into your democratic system, because that's up to the American people.
Tonight on Point, Russia, the United States, and democracy in the former USSR. We begin tonight in Moscow with perspective on today's events. Kim Murphy is Moscow bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. I asked her how Russians are interpreting President Bush's visit.
I think that for Russia, while the Bush visit was clearly the most important of the more than 50 world leaders that were here, it was a couple of days of self-absorption. It was Russia's party. And for them, they were very happy to see that Bush was very much in the mood to enter this festive spirit, the celebrations and mourning that commemorated this very devastating chapter in Russia and the world's history.
Kim, can you describe for us just how much in the midst of those Red Square celebrations President Bush was with Putin?
Clearly, he had the seat of honor, no doubt about it. Putin beamed when he saw Bush walking up to him in the parade of world leaders as they arrived. And then Bush was at Putin's side throughout the event. It was almost a surreal flashback to the Soviet era. There was a gigantic emblem of the USSR atop the entire square. There were red hammer and sickle banners with Lenin's picture on them, Soviet military marches, and Bush was sitting right there at Putin's side, chatting comfortably with him, and then the two of them walked together to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier to lay the wreath there.
When the parade passes by, when all the trumpet blasts are finished, Kim, how do you think the Kremlin is likely to take the overriding message of Bush's trip, which has been support for democracies on Russia's borders and a kind of goad to Putin to support democracy inside Russia?
I think that the Kremlin has heard that message loud and clear for some time now. It was certainly underscored by the fact that Bush capped his visit and preceded his visit to the emerging democracies in Latvia and Georgia. And Putin took the opportunity of the visit to present his own view, which is that Russia is ready for democracy, perhaps on its own timescale and its own terms. He also took the opportunity to remind President Bush that perhaps American democracy is not entirely perfect when you have his own presidency that was achieved during his first term by a decision of the Supreme Court. That said, Russia has pledged to start making some gains for instance, the conduct of its next presidential elections in 2008 in assuring that they're free, fair, and have access to the media for all candidates. I think the White House at this point is ready to see a little bit more action and fewer words.
But in Russia, is there any question that there's been backsliding on democracy? When you talk with democracy advocates there, do they take any comfort in the changes that have led to fewer votes, less democratic participation?
I don't think democracy advocates in Russia are feeling very encouraged these days at all, by no means. They also are in a mode of listening to promises from the Kremlin while they're seeing a reduction in access to an independent media, tightly controlled and managed elections for the Duma, the presidency, and the various republics, lack of democratic elections for regional leaders for the first time this year. The tide has definitely been going the other way.
And what about President Bush's visits to countries nestled right against Russia, former members of the Soviet Union in the Baltics, and today arriving in Georgia, where there's been a sharp push in the last year and a half toward a more democratic setup? Is this seen as meddling? Is it seen as a challenge to Putin? Is the Kremlin taking offense?
Publicly, the Kremlin, during this visit, was very careful not to even mention it. When it was asked, they completely denied that it bothered them at all, but there was no doubt at all that they saw Bush's visits to both of those countries as something that was diplomatically inappropriate. Obviously, Bush has underscored the fact that Georgia is no longer seen by the rest of the world as the kind of satellite state of Russia that Russia at one point saw it as. And it's a very clear message to Russia that its old business as usual is not the way of the 21st century.
I wonder, Kim, what you think, how Russians perceive President Bush in his relationship with Putin. We've seen Bush take Putin for a ride in the pickup truck on the ranch at Crawford. When President Bush goes for a spin in the Volga, Putin's Volga car, at the wheel, how do Russians see that kind of photograph, that chumminess?
Russians, of course, have demonstrated in these last couple of days that they're extremely nostalgic for the old power of the former Soviet Union. They want to be a player on the world stage. And my sense from talking to Russians is that they respect the fact that George Bush is the leader of the most powerful country in the world. And that has a rubbing off effect. If Putin's getting along with Bush, that's going to be good for Russia in the end, I think. And I don't think that was perceived negatively at all.
On the contrary, it sounds. Kim Murphy in Moscow, thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, welcome.
Kim Murphy is Moscow Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. She spoke with me from Moscow. We are talking tonight about Russia, the United States, and democracy in the former Soviet Union. You can join the conversation. Did you get a shiver down your spine watching Soviet artillery parade again in Red Square? And how hard should Washington push Russia on democracy? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Chevy Chase, Maryland, is Michael McFaul, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution and Associate Professor of Political Science at Stanford University. He's co-author of Russia's Unfinished Revolution, Political Change from Gorbachev to Putin. His opinion piece, It's Okay to Scold the Backslider, appeared in Sunday's Los Angeles Times. Michael McFaul, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
So a lot we want to unpack with you tonight, Michael, but first just your thoughts as you watched, no doubt, Putin and Bush side by side on top of Lenin's tomb at the walls of the Kremlin today with all that going on. What was your response to the visuals?
Well, the visuals are striking, of course, as you already alluded to. This did feel like something out of a Soviet-era film. I thought it was very striking that they had out the old Soviet Union flag there with hammer and sickle and Lenin. I was living in Moscow for the 50th anniversary of the Great War, the Great Patriotic mm-hmm. War, as they call it, and I don't recall those flags being brought out. It was very striking. And let's be clear, I mean, this is a very important, almost sacred day in Soviet and Russian history.
And 27 million dead, and the Russians determined to honor that.
That's right, and so they should, and so we should. And I think it was right for the President Bush to go and the other leaders to go and be there at this ceremony. But they could have downplayed some of the Sovietness of the meeting, and they chose not to do that.
And yet, we're struck looking on from outside by the kind of lecturing tone, and just plain lecturing, that President Bush delivered on his way to Moscow. I'm sure we'll hear more of that tomorrow in Georgia. There's a big rally planned there. The contrast between those comments, that pushing from the president, and the image of him side by side with Putin seems very sharp looking on from the U.S. What do you make of it?
Well, President Bush had a very difficult diplomatic task on this trip. I would say after the diplomacy or failed diplomacy leading up to the war in Iraq, this is probably the most difficult diplomatic situation that he's faced. Because on the one hand, he wants to honor and respect the Soviet and Russian people. He also wants to reaffirm his close personal relationship with Putin, and he's invested a lot in that relationship. And at the same time, he wanted to send a signal that he doesn't accept Putin's interpretation of history, and that's why he stopped in Latvia. And he doesn't accept the Russian assumption of a sphere of influence in the former Soviet Union, and that's why he's going to Georgia. So I empathize with him. It was a very difficult task. I thought the itinerary was the correct one with the right messages. However, I thought he blew it a little bit.
On what front?
When he was riding around at the dacha in the car, the chumminess, I liked your choice of words there, that was inappropriate. If you really want to send a signal that you are concerned about democratic erosion in Russia. And so ironically, he's trying to send a complex message, and I think he sent a rather mixed message, but then allows people to be cynical about, well, is he really serious about the democratic cause in Russia?
Yet it's a tough problem, as you say, and who can't see it? There's a lot we want to learn from you tonight, Michael McFaul. We're delighted you're with us. We're talking about Russia, the United States, and democracy in the former Soviet Union. Listeners, you can join us. How did it feel to see George Bush in front of the Kremlin on top of Lenin's tomb with Vladimir Putin? And are you resonating with the scolding Bush or the buddy-buddy Bush, arm-in-arm with the Russian leader? You can join us tonight, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Russia and the United States, about Bush and Putin, and the love-hate or scolding-hugging relationship between Moscow and Washington right now. My guest tonight, Michael McFaul. He's senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, written about all kinds of angles of Russia and its politics and how the U.S. ought to be relating with it. You can join the conversation tonight. Is Vladimir Putin trying to bring back the ways of the USSR? And how hard should Washington push Moscow at home and on its borders on democracy? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Michael McFaul, I wish you'd give us a kind of a capsule picture, just for starters, of what's happening with democracy. First, inside Russia, you've said that Putin has done little to strengthen democracy and much to weaken it. What's he done?
Well, let's start with what came before Putin, to be very clear.
Yes.
That he inherited a regime that was not a liberal democracy.
From Boris Yeltsin, you're saying even after those years of Yeltsin, still nowhere near.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very important for our listeners to understand, is that he came in after a time of chaos and anarchy. It was really a revolutionary time, and I think there's no other word to describe it.
The dismantling of the old Soviet economic structure and all the rest.
Exactly. And the political institutions and the collapse of the empire, the collapse of the state. Mm. I mean, most people within Russia had grown up as Soviet citizens, and overnight they became Russian citizens.
Mm-hmm.
There was no Russian state before 1991.
A fairly diminished status, that.
Yeah, but diminished status, that's part of it, and we were talking about that earlier, but I think it's more important to understand just like, they didn't even know what is in their passport. What country are they a member of?
Yeah.
It was a very a chaotic time,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I'd lived in Russia throughout that period, and mm-hmm. it truly was. So there was a demand for some kind of order and stability, and that demand from society would have been there no matter who came to power after Yeltsin. Putin met that. He said, I'm going to be the guy that calms things down, bring order and stability, and I'm going to make the state stronger. I'm going to reaffirm the power of the state, both internally and externally. Now, his strategy for doing that, I'm not against strong states. I think that's a good mission, and I applaud that generally. But his strategy, I think, has been deeply flawed. His strategy has been to increase centralization within this regime. And so that's why he has clamped down on the press. That's why he has weakened the parliament, weakened political parties, jailed his opponents, harassed civil society, some of them in jail, and others are now watched again by what's called the FSB, the successor organization to the KGB.
I mean, you describe him sort of cracking down, reining in on all fronts, on the Federal Council, the Duma, the Houses of Parliament, independent media, regional governors, no longer elected, appointed, prime minister's office, independent political parties. I mean, just you say the presidency is now the only meaningful center of decision-making in the country. That reminds us of the Soviet Union. Is that wrong?
Yes and no. Mm-hmm. It's right in that it is more autocratic today than 4 years ago in terms of decision-making. And the Soviet Union was also an autocratic or totalitarian regime. It's not the Soviet Union in two major respects. First of all, it's not the Soviet Union in that all economic resources are not controlled by the state, and Putin has never said that he wants to do that.
Though there's been a lot of apprehension in business circles about the way he's gone after oil company chiefs and even reined in some of business there.
Well, that's right. He has this, I think he has a flawed theory of economic development. So he doesn't want to go back to the old totalitarian communist system. He wants private property, but he doesn't want private property of strategic assets.
Mm-hmm.
So oil and gas, he wants to bring that back into the state.
That's a pretty big chit to pull back.
That's a pretty big, especially in the Russian economy.
Yes.
That's a big chunk of it. Second, when increasing centralization, increasing autocracy, if you will, does not lead to a more effective state. And that I think, is the principal analytic distinction that he doesn't understand. I can think of lots of states today that are run by dictators. Angola, for instance, comes to mind, a place I've also worked on. Yes, all decision-making is in the hands of the presidency, but it's not an effective state. He makes a decision, and decision-making, the decision made by the president doesn't get out of the capital of Luanda.
So pulling the power back into the Kremlin doesn't guarantee anything. Michael McFaul, look beyond the Soviet borders with us for a moment, if you will, because President Bush is clearly giving a tip of the hat, even to those he's not visiting, the sort of necklace of former Soviet states all around its perimeter now, Latvia where he is, Georgia where he is, Ukraine that he's talking about, Moldova, more. He's saying, bravo, you go, we're with you. What's the significance of that tension with him applauding this democratic movements on the perimeter and pushing Putin at home?
Well, first of all, I think he's absolutely right to applaud this, what I would call a second wave of democratization. Because in Ukraine, in Georgia, in Kyrgyzstan, and I would even add to that list Serbia in 2000, you have had an overthrow of semi-autocratic leaders in all these places that had been languishing in terms of its democratic consolidation for a decade. And now suddenly a real demonstration effect has happened between these countries, and you're seeing democratic breakthrough. And the President Bush is absolutely right to applaud that. It should not be seen, as he's trying to emphasize, as a threat to Russia. Stable democratic states on the borders of Russia is in Russia's national interest.
But isn't Russia going to see or worry? I mean, now in Georgia, the United States has military advisors, even though Russia still has bases there. We know Georgia wants them out. Isn't Russia going to see potentially American client states in these embraced states on its perimeter?
Well, now we have to break down and stop calling Russia. Russia wants this, Russia wants that, because some Russians see it exactly the way you just described. My guess is that Putin and his entourage see it that way.
And they're rather important.
Well, they're most important, and probably that is a majority view within Russia. But there are certainly other Russians, people I know personally, who don't see it that way, who think at the end of the day they want Russia to be part of that international community of states that Ukraine and Georgia are now moving towards. And they would like to see Russia integrated into the West, not being an anchor for some kind of opposition bloc. And that really is the central drama moving forward in Russia today. And by the way, this is a debate that goes way back in Russian history
between
the Slavophiles and the Westernizers.
Sure.
Here it is again.
Let me ask you, Michael McFaul, can the United States have it both ways with Russia? Can they embrace democracies right on its borders, where Russia still has interests that it wants to pursue? And clearly, it's tried to very recently in Ukraine. We saw, I mean, my God, the president's face still disfigured from an apparent intervention there. Can the United States embrace all that necklace around Russia? Can they criticize Russia inside, what it's doing inside, and still have a friendly or warm relationship? Is there a break point here? And if there is, what does it matter?
Well, I think we most certainly can embrace new democracies in the former Soviet Union and at the same time have a separate and distinct policy towards Russia and President Putin. I don't think some people think it's a trade-off. I don't buy that. I think, you know, we should be able to chew gum and walk at the same time. Second, I don't think it is the case that if you stop talking about your values and stop talking about democracy, you're going to get a more cooperative Russia, and a more cooperative Putin, let me be more precise.
Mm.
We tried that. We did that. That's what the first term of the Bush administration was. And did not talking about, you know, what most people would describe as genocide in Chechnya make Mr. Putin any more cooperative?
We were told that Russia was cooperative on terrorism, was he not?
Yeah, and the proof is in the pudding, right? My friends in the government say, oh, Mike, you don't know. We're doing all these things secretively, and they're really great allies. I look at it very differently. I look at Chechnya, and I look at the way that they are fighting the war in Chechnya, and I think that that war is inspiring the terrorists and our enemies, not bringing them to justice.
So maybe bringing more trouble than it's solving with a kind of flatten everything policy. Michael McFaul, stand by. I want to begin to bring our callers in. We're at 1-800-423-8255, and Greg is calling from Boston. Hi, Greg. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say my father was a young boy in eastern Poland, which was partitioned by the Molotov-Ribbentrop Accord in 1939.
Yes, this is the one that allied the Soviet Union with Hitler's Germany.
Right. So basically, my father was a teenager in 1939 when the Soviets started the war.
Mm-hmm.
And my father experienced 20 months of some of the most brutal occupation by the Soviets, including neighbors disappearing at night, friends, family, so much so that when he was deported to Germany, he made a decision not to come back.
Mm.
I regularly speak to people in Ukraine because I'm fluent in the language.
Yes.
And they are absolutely petrified of Putin and Bush, this new friendship that they have, notwithstanding the wonderful support that Bush gave President Yushchenko when he came to the United States. They all feel they're getting mixed messages again, and they've been burned in the past. At very least, everyone feels that if Bush was up there, he should not have been buddy-buddy with Putin. He should have stood, for example, with the Polish prime minister or the Ukrainian prime minister or the Latvian prime minister and had very stern and very formal messages giving that to the Russian people that they recognize that they defeated Nazi Germany, but that they should also have a message that Russia started the war and Russia occupied these countries and was, in most Eastern Europeans' point of view, far more brutal than the Nazis were.
Instead, what we saw on the reviewing stand today was a very, very stiff welcome from Putin for Viktor Yushchenko from Ukraine, as you might imagine, followed by a very warm welcome of President Bush. And you're saying these images, this chumminess is really bothering your friends. Greg, thanks for that observation. Let us look at that. I want to welcome into our conversation, along with Michael McFaul, joining us now from Chevy Chase, Maryland, William Maines. He's president of the Eurasia Foundation. William Maines, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
So there you are. Eurasia Foundation, 80% funded by the U.S. government. I guess you're devoted to building democratic and free market institutions in the independent states of the former USSR.
We are.
You were editor of Foreign Policy magazine for 17 years, or the journal.
That's right.
And what do you think of this interesting juxtaposition of Bush as the kind of chummy pal of Putin and Bush as the critic of Russia?
Well, much that I've heard, I agree with, but a lot I don't. I mean, the opposition in Russia is not in jail. Its problem is that it's too weak It doesn't have much support.
It doesn't get much stronger without independent media, without...
The statement was made that the opposition is in jail, and that's just not true. They are weak. They don't have much support, and they don't have much support for the reasons that Michael mentioned, which is that in Russia, Democrats, small d, are associated with the decline in living standards, with the disintegration of the state, with months without salaries being paid, with pensions not being paid, with the country falling apart. And the problem in building democracy is, I think, myself, finding a new generation who can take up the banner. I think the people who are associated with the 1950s really stand very little chance of getting much support.
But this sounds like the old argument that Russians just aren't cut out for democracy.
No, it could leave the U.S. sounding like apologists for Putin. That's not it at all. It's simply that if a party that you had in power destroys your way of life, destroys your state, or at least is perceived as having done that, you're very unlikely to vote it back in office. And when Putin took over, as Michael said, the country was ready to fall apart. There were books being written by prominent American experts on Russia predicting that the country would break up into three or four parts. And that has been stopped.
So give Putin credit for that, you're saying. That order that he's brought is,
well,
Michael McFaul says.
He's paid. Pensions are being paid. Wages are being paid. The standard of living has sharply risen. All these are very positive steps on Putin's part. He's restored the finances of the state. He's imposed pushed and imposed on the system new economic measures that have greatly improved the future of the country. They've got a massive trade surplus, massive budget surplus. It's been one of the fastest growing areas in the world.
But Americans have learned from hard...
That's why he's popular, and we have to take that into account.
But Americans have learned from hard experience that a non-democratic leader, just because he delivers on some of these fronts, is not necessarily a good thing ultimately for that country and the world. Hitler was beloved in the 30s in Germany.
This is one of the problems in the United States. Comparisons like that are just totally ridiculous.
Well, I don't mean to compare him to Hitler. I'm only saying that we've learned.
Putin is not Hitler, and even to use that phrase is totally to disport... to distort the reality of what's going on in Russia. There has been, quite correctly, as Michael has said, there has been a retreat from some of the advances that were made on the Democratic front in the 90s. But it is far from a totalitarian dungeon.
Mm.
There's debate on Russian television. I watch it myself.
Yes.
I see it.
Mm-hmm.
There's prominent debate in the Russian press. I see it. Russia no longer has any kind of ideology that tries to conquer the world. It does want to be a prominent state in its region, and that creates problems because its interests sometimes conflict with those of others, and and those other states have a perfect right to reach out to the United States, as some of them have.
Are doing,
but we need to sort of de-escalate this criticism of Russia because it's dangerous to make suggestions comparing Putin to Hitler.
Well, and I'm really not doing that, only saying that efficiency, we've learned, is not enough. Michael McFaul, how about it? You're saying it's okay to scold the backslider. William Maines is saying yes, but, they've got their own organic way here, and let's not get too fired up about it.
Well, first, that title of my piece in the LA Times is a terrible, terrible title.
Okay, the headline writer.
They chose that title. I didn't. But
okay.
But here is, we do, I think, somewhat disagree in that, yes, there is debate in the media, but the state has not done anything to facilitate it. It's limited it. The largest, most popular television station in Russia, NTV, from 4 or 5 years ago, is now controlled by the state. And lots of other smaller publications, including one that used to be edited by one of my colleagues at the Moscow Carnegie Center, was shut down for no other reason than it was doing things and saying things that the state didn't like. Moreover, Bill's absolutely right that the reason why democracy is in disarray in Russia today, first and foremost, is because those who claim to be Democrats in the 90s, whether they were or not, we could have a whole conversation on
that.
But they grabbed the word Democrat, and they said, I am a Democrat, and I am going to do these things in the name of democracy.
Mm.
Most people rejected what they did. And that is going to be a generational change before they reconfigure themselves. And in the vacuum, you have a real nationalist threat that's coming in to fill the vacuum. But some of those people are harassed by the state. I mean, you have this very ironic situation in Russia today, where on the one hand, President Bush recently, about a year and a half ago, went to the National Endowment for Democracy and said, I think what you do in the world is great. I want to double your budget. And he did. And then one of the grantees of the National Endowment for Democracy is the Russian-Chechen Friendship Society.
Mm.
The Russian-Chechen Friendship Society today is being harassed by the very same man that Putin, that Bush was standing on the podium with yesterday.
We've got more to look at here. Michael McFaul, William Maines, please stand by. Listeners, you can join us. Do you believe Vladimir Putin is taking Russia on a path to democracy or burying Russia's democratic hopes? 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Russia, the United States, and democracy in the former Soviet Union. I'm joined by Michael McFaul. He's a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, and by William Maines, president of the Eurasia Foundation. You can join us as well. Are you resonating with the scolding Bush we've seen on this trip, or with the buddy-buddy Bush, arm in arm with the Russian leader? Can the U.S. president have it both ways here? And how hard should Washington push Moscow on democracy? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Kate is calling from Yonkers in New York. Hi, Kate. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a comment that I do agree with your guest, Michael, because I am from Republic of Georgia,
mm-hmm.
and this issue has very long history and just very complex background, and I do think that it is possible for U.S. to have separate encouraging policy towards emerging democracies and different approach to Russia's political approaches to what they're trying to achieve.
So for Georgia, for Russia, Kate, should President Bush be confrontational with Moscow? Should he be friendly? Has he got the right mix going right now?
Well, I think that the comment that it is ambiguity of what is this complex message that
mm-hmm.
Bush was sending is quite correct. I do agree that even if it may be very just not shown as clearly by Putin, he is very discouraged or I don't know, for lack of a better word, that Bush is visiting Georgia, and I do think that's very important. But to answer your question, he does need to be challenging, but it is clear that Putin is very defensive on many fronts, and I do believe the mixture of diplomacy is very important.
So you say keep a bit of both there. Kate, thanks very much for your call. Michael McFaul, I want to ask, if I may, about Condoleezza Rice's impact here. Of course, she's been close to the president for some time. Now she's not only close to him, she's Secretary of State, and she is, famously, a scholar of Russia and before the Soviet Union. Can you see her stamp in the American posture toward Russia right now?
Well, of course, she's the chief policymaker for Russia in the Bush administration. Condi, I can call her Condi because I've known her for 25 years. My colleague from Stanford, she has always thought, when she came first as national security advisor, that you develop a good relationship with Mr. Putin, and then that will translate into things you want to get done in foreign policy.
Mm.
So if you remember, when Bush first made that trip and met with Putin that first time,
mm-hmm.
and he had these glowing words to say about him, I looked into his soul and, you know, I saw a man I could trust.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't him just, speaking off the cuff or making what I called a rookie mistake, I think is what I said about that. No, that was a plan that I'm going to develop a rapport with him, and then that's going to make it easier for me to rip up the ABM treaty.
You're saying Condi Rice was whispering in the president's ear, say that you looked into his eyes and you saw his soul, you saw a man you could trust. That was Machiavellian kind of buttering up of Vladimir Putin?
Well, it was a means to a foreign policy ends that they wanted to achieve at the time. And let's remember, before September 11th, this was the number one security objective of the Bush administration. Whether it was right or wrong is a different debate. I think it was categorically wrong. But that's what it was about, right? So you develop
the ABM treaty, getting it out.
Right. Now, the problem I have with that approach is I now see the relationship, and I think it's always better to have good relations rather than bad with big, important countries like Russia. But it's a means to an end. It's not an end in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
And what I don't see right now, and this is, you know, Condi's challenge, if you will.
Yes.
What is it that we're getting from this rapport with Mr. Putin right now? How is it translating into things that the president himself has said are his core foreign policy issues? And let's remember, he was the one, not me.
Yes.
He was the one that said in his second inaugural address that I'm going to make the advance of democracy worldwide my chief foreign policy objective. So that's his, by his standards, we have to judge him by what he defined as his objectives. And I just don't see how the translation, if you will, of this warm rapport, how is that helping Russian democracy?
William Maines, let me bring that to you. Our caller Kate says good for the warmth as well as the pressure. Michael McFaul is not sure that the rapport is buying much in terms of the president's stated goal of encouraging freedom and democracy. What do you say?
Well, the president has more than one stated goal. Another goal is to try to deal with the proliferation problem around the world, and we need Russia's help on that. Another is to deal with states like North Korea and Iran, and we need Russia's help on that front. These are issues that are at least as important for the president as the ones that we've been discussing. And I think, to give Bush credit, Putin, first of all, has charmed many people, not just the president, when he's met with him. So I don't think it was some Machiavellian plot on the part of our leaders. I think they were surprised that they found such an intelligent and well-informed leader. And other leaders in Western Europe have reacted exactly the same way, although not used such effusive language.
Mm.
But secondly, Bush, we've got to remember, did acquire something from Putin that no one expected.
What was that?
Which is after September 11th, when we decided that we wanted and needed to attack Afghanistan, we needed something that that no Western ally could give us, which was proximity to the problem.
Yep.
And Russia allowed us to do that. Now,
you mean in putting forward troops in former Soviet republics?
Absolutely. And I was in Russia at the time, and all of the leaders of Russia, including the defense minister, said, this will never happen. It will never happen.
Mm.
We will not agree to this.
And yet?
And yet, Putin overruled them. And I think he overruled them because of, first of all, I think he saw further than some of his own leaders who were too trapped in the past, but I have no doubt that it also reflects a confidence that he had in Bush, that Bush needed this, that he was going to provide it to him, and Bush would not betray him.
So there's the depiction of this as a kind of matter of trade-offs, keep the warmth and keep the pressure and have the benefits on both sides. Valerie's calling from Queens, New York. Valerie, you're on the air. What do you think?
Yes. Hi. I want to comment on the remarks of the gentleman who spoke. I mean, he was against comparing. I was born and raised in Russia and immigrated, natural citizen of this country.
Okay.
And today, one of the Russian-speaking TV stations, not in Russia, but the American Russian-speaking
yes.
TV,
mm-hmm.
not everybody can receive that.
Yes.
They showed how Putin and the authorities, they gathered all the reporters. No reporters were allowed to visit the events. They gathered them in one hall, one building, fed them the images on TV screens and told them, this is what is happening, this is... And some of the reporters mentioned, said that there were so many pictures of Putin with a glass of champagne, Putin with this.
Mm-hmm.
And me, coming from Russia, how can I fail to compare this to what Joseph Goebbels did? I mean, Joseph Goebbels collected all the reporters in the propaganda ministry and told them what to write about their regime. It's not the Nazi regime yet, but it's moving in that direction. And I was, when I was in Minsk, I was in a group of human rights campaigns, dissidents, fighting for the human rights. And, of course, Jimmy Carter was the president. Mm-hmm. He helped us a lot. And people like Putin, the KGB, they arrested us. They put us in mental homes. And he is now the president.
But what about the argument, Valeri, that he has brought order where there was chaos and got Russia stabilized? He offers practical advantages to the United States in his occasional, you know, alliance friendships or acts of friendship. What do you make of all that?
Well, let me give you just one example.
Yes.
If you declare democracy and freedom for everybody, so you cannot, there's a British saying, you know, you cannot eat the pudding and have it.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot say, look, you're free republics, but at the same time, no, Chechnya is going to be our, you know, domain.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is one example. You know, Chechnya is nobody. See, the Russians didn't want to let it go, and this is what is happening. They killed so many people there. They destroyed virtually the republic. And so why, I mean, if you declare, I mean, freedom for everybody, so why not Chechnya let go?
And you don't see it happening there. We hear the depth of your concern. We've got it. Valeri, thank you very much for calling in from Queens. Let's take another call right here. Vaughn is calling from Greensboro, North Carolina. Vaughn, what do you think?
I hear a lot of people calling from Russia and the former Soviet republics, and I think that you don't have to be from one of those places to be a little concerned. You know, didn't we just a few months ago have Viktor Yushchenko? Someone tried to poison him and,
yes,
and murder him,
mm-hmm,
and he's a pro-Western candidate that Putin did everything he possibly could to thwart this guy's candidacy.
We saw that loud and clear. On the other hand, Vaughn, as William Maine says, when the United States went to Afghanistan, Vladimir Putin was very helpful. So there can be favors done here at the same time. What's the right balance, Vaughn?
I think you've got to hold a hard line. You know, I mean, I can't imagine that. I just wonder where the outrage from the world is when a major government like Russia is attempting to kill off a candidate from a former nation state.
Well, people were upset pretty much at the time. Vaughn, thank you very much for your call. Michael McFaul, both these callers saying, gee, we don't like the looks of this, and Bush should be very tough. William Maine saying, let's not forget there are advantages in keeping this friendly line open. So what is the right balance, the right posture here?
Well, I think both sides are right. I mean, we absolutely needed the Russians in the war in Afghanistan, and not so much the basings in the Central Asian countries, because at the end of the day, the Russians couldn't have blocked that. But actually, in the conduct of the war, the Northern Alliance was armed and trained by the Russians, and they were our allies there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's good. I don't believe in going back to some kind of containment strategy with the Russians. I think it's in our interest to have cordial relations with Mr. Putin, diplomatic relations that allows us to do these other things in terms of helping to develop democratic society within Russia. But I don't think you have to check your values at the door when you're talking about arms control or you're talking about Afghanistan or you're talking about Iran. And that to me is the false linkage that sometimes goes on. Well, because we need his cooperation on this here, we're not going to talk about Chechnya.
Our time is short. I want to ask you about another point you've made, Michael McFaul. You said that you're not sure we'll get a competitive election when Vladimir Putin, if he tries to run for office again or take office again in 2008, Constitution says no, he may do it anyway. But you've written that in a truly competitive election, a nationalist socialist coalition is likely to produce the most popular candidate. So does the U.S. in that sense really want democracy in the Soviet in Russia?
Yes. And I say that because with all the metaphorical references to Hitler aside that we've had in this last hour, and I don't share those comparisons. Mm. I'm glad, however, that you can make those comparisons and freely. Those are some things that you can increasingly not do in Russia. Having said that, no, I think elections, real elections, are the best anecdote, if you will, immunity from extremists. I think that may be the case, but I think over time, elections are the best way for, you know, to get to the kind of median voter, the average Ivan Ivanovich in Russia. So I don't fear that at all, even if in the short term it could be a rocky road.
As we talk tonight, do you expect Russians will get that in 2008, or are they headed in a more authoritarian direction?
There's going to be an election. I think there will be an election for sure. How free and how fair it is a very open question.
Well, our time has flown by. Michael McFaul, a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, co-author of Russia's Unfinished Revolution, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
And William Maines, president of the Eurasia Foundation, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
In a moment, horror writer Stephen King's advice to the class of 2005. This is On Point. It is May, which means it's commencement season at colleges and universities across the country. Throughout this month, On Point will be bringing you excerpts from notable commencement addresses around the nation. Tonight, we bring you horror writer Stephen King, who spoke over the weekend at the University of Maine, his home state. King, who is best known for giving his readers nightmares, used his speech to give 10 pieces of advice to the class of 2005, advice which at times touched on hot political and social issues. Don't let your health slide in America's SUV-loving, fast-food-eating culture, he said. Do stay informed and keep reading. Do thank every single person who helped you graduate from college. And this piece of wisdom from Stephen King.
Give away a dime of every dollar you make. Why not? If you don't give it, the government's just going to take it back. You think you can't afford to give away one lousy thin dime out of every dollar? If you think you can't, just look at the taxes you pay on every gallon of gas you buy. If you think you can't, look at all the sick, unhappy, uneducated people standing outside the fence America has constructed around herself. People who only want a little something for themselves and their families, for their children. Very few of them are suicide bombers. Very few of them are Mr. Bush's enemies of freedom, whether he believes that or not. They might become enemies of freedom, but right now, all they want is a little something to get by on, a little chance at the kind of joy most of you are feeling right now, a dime out of every dollar. And here's a secret I learned 6 summers ago, lying in a ditch beside the road, covered in my own blood, and thinking that I was going to die. You go out broke. Everything's on loan anyway. You're not an owner. You're only a steward. So pass some of it on. You may not have much now, but you're going to have a lot. And when you do, remember the ones who don't have anything. A dime out of every dollar. If everybody did it, maybe we could make Mr. Bush let go of the weapons he loves so well and give back some of the money. And give back some of the money that he spends on them to the farmers, the unwed mothers, and the working poor.
Horror writer Stephen King speaking at this week's commencement at the University of Maine in Orono, Maine. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.